Blog Talk Radio.
Tuned into the 152nd class of Soul Class and the 36th edition of In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah. This is your humble cyberspace Torah activist, Don Zosir Goodman. Hope everyone's feeling very well. And we want to remind everyone that Soul is an acronym for the S7. O, oldest, the original U, universal L, Lord, the seven universal Noahide commandments. Blessed souls, we're listening now, as we'll turn down the volume, to Isaac Yitzhak Baton, blessed soul brother, praising the same congregation, Mita Frankel Shul in Crown Heights. Here comes the time from his Generation Redemption album. We'll just turn on the volume, and we'll get right to the meat of the show. Blessed is our Creator. We continue with our series, Probing Genesis. Chapter 2, verse 10, quote, "And a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from thence it was parted and became four heads." A river, Eden, or Eden, water and garden, and then it split or parted and became the heads of four rivers. What is it alluding to, blessed souls? Hopefully we will probe these matters and other discussions like the medical practices of Rambam, Rabbi Moses ben Maimonides, also author of Mishnah Torah, the wisdom of Rabbi Nachman, the path of the Rashi Gentile, compassion for humanity in the Jewish tradition by Rabbi David Sears. Whenever it comes down the pipeline, when conversations live on Blessed Blog Talk Radio show. soul class dedicated to helping you lubricate your human consciousness in a higher, more dignified manner with your divine image. Joining me tonight is, as usual, Ruch Hashem, blessed be the Most High, is Dennis Ryan, our teacher, student, advocate for the dissemination of the teachings of Rabbi Moshe ben Maimonides. Good evening, Dennis. How are you doing?
Good evening, Don. Fine. Yourself?
Thank God. Today I had a day off and my children didn't have school today. Well, actually, one of them did, one of them didn't, but we pulled my son out. We went to the Museum of Natural History and we saw that history has quite a nature to it. Whether you want to talk about animal history, we saw a very interesting video today about the history of vertebrates, about all this trouble that 90 tons of gold are making since the beginning of creation as people try to excavate it, try to work with it, and the gold rushes out in California, all over the place. You know, people scream out for gold, but still, there's something greater than gold, Dennis, and blessed souls. There's your soul, your human soul, which is, you know, if you take the collection of all human beings that ever lived from day one on planet Earth, from the time that Adam and Eve, original man and woman, graced this earth to this day, you certainly will have greater worth, because it's an incalculable worth. What is the value of the human soul? We don't measure people by their assets, but really that their human soul, empowered by their divine image, assists them and enables them to carry out their mission in this earth. You know, Dennis, earlier, I guess it was within an hour and a half of tonight's show, I just was haphazardly listening to the radio, relaxing a little bit, and I turned on 101.9 here in New York City, which is an FM all-news station, and I was listening to how an elephant was being called the Lance Armstrong, of course, Lance Armstrong being the international, American, champion bike rider, and apparently there's an elephant who has earned that distinction by winning their, I think you mentioned me, Dennis, their ninth race in a row, and then they're now, at the end of that brief radio broadcast, they're being given the honor, or I would like to call it the dishonor, of carrying an idol to a certain place where people would pay homage to that idol. So, Dennis, you mentioned to me before the show that you heard something about this story. Any comments, concerns about this issue?
Well, it happened in a land where most people practice the religion that after you die, you're reincarnated as an animal. So what happens is this is called the land of India, basically, that practices this type of religion. So when an elephant distinguishes itself, they take great interest in that because they have adopted as their different gods different animals or animal-like figures. And the one that represents the elephant is called Ganoush. And there's a lot of followers of Ganoush. But they feel proud that the elephant did something because they're associating that to their religion. Yes, the idol they treat as their god. And the honor is that the people who own the elephant or they'll parade it on the elephant so everybody can see it. So to them, that's a great thing. To us, we have a different viewpoint of that, don't we, Don?
Well, I wasn't going to really talk about this subject matter tonight, but because it just came up, and I don't think anything is of coincidence, and we can cover the whole spectrum of the seven Noahide commandments, I feel I do want to start the show by pulling more quicker than I thought it would from the path of the righteous Gentile, which is by Rabbi Chaim Klorfin and Rabbi Yaakov Rogalsky. And we'll be pulling out from page 48, chapter 5, concerning the concept of idolatry, what and how idolatry poses a big problem in terms of the fulfillment of the seven universal laws. And it goes like this. The essence of the seven universal laws is the prohibition against idolatry. One who worships another deity besides the Creator denies the essence of religion and rejects the entirety of the seven universal laws. But one who guards himself against idolatry demonstrates belief in the Almighty and affirms the entirety of the seven universal laws. Now, we actually have a parallel within the 613 commandment paradigm, Dennis, for any of you blessed souls listening out there. Of course, you want to call in to make the show a little more organic. You can by calling in at 347-838-8669. And that is that according to the oral tradition of the laws of Shabbat, when the nation of Israel keeps Shabbat, that the proper, and I mean the proper total observation of the Shabbat, which is not a simple thing, even though it's a day of rest, is actually a testimony that one affirms one's total belief in the Creator and affirms his or her belief in the entirety of the 613 commandment system. But concerning the commandment prohibiting idolatry, this is a universal command, as Robert Rogalis can quote from Bring Down, that is teaching that no one should serve any created thing, not an angel, not a plant, not a star, nothing of the four fundamentals of the elements of the earth, which are basically the earth, the dirt, water, fire, and air, nor anything that is formulated from them. And even if the worshiper knows that God is the supreme being and worships creation as a way of glorifying God's greatness and his ability to create beings and things, nevertheless, this is idol worship. So what my concern is this, Dennis, is that here I am, I mean, you know, I have a certain awareness, not total, but I have a certain awareness of the prohibition of idolatry, and I suddenly turn on the radio, and I hear this elephant being praised for winning a race. Okay, it won a race, and then being given the honor, as it was described, of carrying the idol. Now, the person reading this blip, this radio news piece, did not condemn it. At the same time, too, they weren't praising it. But my concern is that the average person listening, who does not distinguish between what is true worship of the one Creator, which is a very important point for all of us to try to learn more and more about, and myself, more than anyone else, I include myself in that category. I'm still a student. I haven't come up to any conclusive ultimate statements about the Creator, meaning that I am a work in progress. I am a work in progress who is trying to build this consciousness based on a truly one source of all creation. I've made mistakes in the past in my theological notions, in my studies, and my discussion with others, but I still assert after my first 49 years, almost 50 years of life, in the last 26 plus years in keeping a Torah lifestyle, that there is truly one source of all creation. But the average person who doesn't distinguish between, say, one God and, say, a God of all gods is hearing a radio broadcast, and I'm wondering what's going on in the mind, Dennis, if you can comment. What's going on, you think, when the average person hears an elephant is being honored with the honor of carrying an idol, and this is something going on in India. Say, like a person in America, what they're thinking about hearing about an elephant being honored to carry an idol.
Well, I believe that the news station that you're referring to, I listen to as well, happens to drop that news item as a news item, as information, into the media stream. But they didn't put it in context. They didn't tell you the connection between the religious belief and the elephants and how they use them as idols. Instead, it treated it as this was a contest, and the winner of the contest got an honorable award to be able to take this statuette or whatever it is and display it. But it didn't happen in New Jersey. It didn't happen in Pennsylvania. It didn't happen in New York. It happened in a place where people believe in that they're going to be reincarnated. And they do. They pick out certain animals and they say, gee, this is the one I want to be, which sounds nice, but no one has ever been over the other side to say if that works or not. But, yes, it's a form of idolatry, and by definition, and there's no way of getting around that.
Yes. And, Dennis, I'm happy to let you know, and other blessed souls listening in, that we have our Noahide Chassid, Ron Williams. Ron, good evening.
Hey, good evening, Dennis and Don. How are you?
Okay, Ron.
Dennis and I started the show by running, jumping into a fire pan with the fire on and the butter melting in the skillet pan, and we'll ask you to jump in with us. It's nice and warm. And we're talking about a news piece that I just heard within an hour and a half before tonight's show about an elephant that's called like the Lance Armstrong of elephants because it won for the ninth consecutive year a certain race that elephants are run on. And then it was given the distinction of carrying an idol to a certain shrine where the people can worship it. So I was just, before you came on, I was quoting from the Path Righteous Gentile by Rabbi Klorfin and Vygotsky that the idea of worshiping idols is the antithesis to the belief in the one true God and the whole system of the seven Noahic commandments, and how actually we of Israel, we have something which kind of parallels that if we honor the Shabbat and try to keep it properly, and I mean truly properly in spirit and in action, is that we are affirming our belief in the one true God and our belief in the whole 13 commandments. So my question to you is this, I agree with what Dennis said, and you caught the tail end of what Dennis said, but what do you think, is there any impact of, say, someone listening to America, what seems to be a curious story of an elephant who wins a race, and then an idol is placed on its back, or I don't know, its shoulders or whatever, they tie it onto him, so they can bring it to a shrine where people can worship the idol. What do you think? Do you think this causes any problems or could weaken people's belief? Or what is your take on this, that this is a piece of mainstream news media?
I think it's for mere entertainment purposes, actually, us hearing it, because I'm not aware of... I've been pretty close to Hindus, and I've learned a little of their culture and their religious belief, because they're many times, the marketplace back home, they had photographs of their spiritual images that they believe in, and mm-hmm. many times they carry like multiple arms, and I always ask, why would they have that many hands? And they said it actually signified the amount of powers that emanate from this image. And the thing is, their imagery is actually, they're actually conduits for bringing a certain amount of spirituality from their realm into ours. They're actually one of the most spiritual religious groups or sects in the arena of all the world religions. And I remember speaking to Rabbi Yossi Markel, a mutual friend of ours. Actually I met him through you. And he said that Hinduism is one of the true religions. It was one of the religions, one of the oldest religions, in comparison to the modern religions of Christianity and Islam. And it's actually it's a branch from the Abrahamic faith. And then he sent his sons east with those names he gave them. They were the ones that helped establish the Hindu religion. And many of their things are very symbolic, and it's not in and of itself as what we may see it as. Nevertheless, it did then deviate into idolatry because of the years going by. And in the beginning, children see the parents worshipping in a certain way or a certain form, and not understanding quite well what it was. It kept going to the point where the actual form or image was worshipped instead of the symbolic reason why it was. Anyways, it developed into a full-blown idolatrous religion right now. But today in my neighborhood, there was a festival called Pagwa, a Hindu festival where people get powdered with red and white powders, and it's very colorful, and that was happening here today in my neighborhood. So,
interesting. Yeah. And what is the? Do you not understand what is the implication of them getting powdered with those colors?
I never really got the full explanation on that, because I guess the guys I spoke to, they weren't very knowledgeable in this, about this religion, this particular festival. They say it's a joyous festival, and you eat a lot of sweets, and it's very festive and colorful. But I didn't get the true essence of this celebration.
No, I guess someone listening to me might consider me, say, like, be, and I'll say it, I'll put it on the table, ethnocentric, because I know from, you know, now we're in the next 30 days of getting ready for the festival of Passover. And Passover, while it is considered to be the birth of the nation of Israel, it also was our first affirmation as a nation to totally reject the idea of idolatry. And whereas we sacrificed the lamb, the Paschal lamb, because the Paschal lamb was connected to the guardian angel of the Egyptians, according to, and the Egyptians had a very, very complicated spiritual system. I mean, anyone who thinks the Egyptians were not a sophisticated civilization, they, Lubavitcher Rebbe spoke about, they were the most intelligent civilization of their time. They were extremely sophisticated. We talked about it last week. They even did surgery, and I was just listening to a program today from an American Indian, a true Northern American, that the idea of sutures has long been a tradition in ancient peoples and surgeries that was even in the West already. And you know, this idea of sacrificing to or giving homage to something aside from the Creator is not rooted in stupidity. It's not rooted in ignorance. It's rooted in a type of respect, but it's not the type of respect that the Creator wanted. The Creator did not want us to worship other beings, not because he needed more attention, but because as a loving, merciful Father, that by us connecting directly to him and not through an intermediary, we're able to access a higher, soulful, more meaningful connection. And on the human level, in terms of human idolatry, we're just coming out of the festival of Purim. And one of the things that got Haman, or Haman, so angry is that the righteous Mordechai would not bow down to Haman. And Haman actually had an idolatrous trinket that was, it was either suspended on his neck or on his belt. And therefore, if you bow down to him, it's like you were not only bowing down to him, you were bowing down to his idol. Because he understood that this would weaken the power of the Jewish nation by bowing down to idols. And as well, just one more point, and then I'll let Dennis and Ron come and give some feedback and my point of view, that Moses, at times, when he was going to communicate with the Almighty, when he was already positioned in Egypt, in the last several months of the stay of the Israelites in Egypt before the Great Exodus, would actually leave parts of the city to have direct communication, make direct prayer, as Rashi, the foremost commentator on the oral Torah, elucidating on the written Torah, wrote that the idols in the city were creating some sort of interference in the connection between Moses and the Most High. So again, idolatry is not rooted in something which is lacking intelligence. There is something very intelligent about the application of human efforts towards idolatry, but the problem is it's the wrong approach. And therefore we implore people to step away from going through an intermediate, whether it be a sun, a moon, or a man, anything, a created entity, the water spirit, the wind spirit, the fire spirit, and go to the one who is the source of everything. And we should see as a human family that our prayers are answered more efficiently with the blessings of the Most High. Dennis, I'd like to get your comments or any feedback, and then Ron.
Well, the different religions were founded in their own knowledge, but they refused to take it one more step. That you take the Egyptians, for instance, the ancient Egyptians, one of their biggest gods was the god of sun called Ra. And they believed that a lot of power and everything else could be transposed from the god to them. A lot of their figures are half animal, half human form. So what happens is they didn't really elevate their thinking to a supernatural level, even though they believed in certain supernatural things. So I have to say that the ancient Egyptians were incomplete. Maimonides has written about, let's say, the Muslims, and he didn't say that they're wrong. he politely explained how they took the wrong turn. They should have been staying on the straight and narrow path that they that Judaism was on, but they decided, based on their oral religion or their oral ways, that they were going to take different twists and turns in the road, and they ended up leading themselves astray. So what we have here is that humans, rather than basing it on faith and belief, they thought that they could mentally figure out everything, and therefore they didn't really need God for everything because they were figuring it out. These people are misinformed. They took the wrong way, and they're following their ancestors, and you can't get that. You can't convince them otherwise, because then you're dissing on their ancestors. Some of these people just can't accept that. But if you don't have an open mind, how can you accept God? And you cannot do it just by formula, methodology, and pure rote. You were given a mind, an intellectual mind, when we were born. You must use it. You have a free will.
True, true. Ron, before we go to Ron, I want to mention that I've heard African historians or people who are students of African historians assert, and I haven't really done enough research on this, that not all of the African kings of Egypt were idolaters. In fact, there were monotheists in some of their dynasties. I don't know if it was the beginning of their dynasty, the middle. Maybe there was a period after the Exodus where they saw, because Pharaoh himself testified that, now I know that, you know, the Most High is the righteous, and I'm the wicked one. That he, you know, there was some sort of recognition, and maybe from that point on, historically speaking, from the Exodus, and Egypt was totally destroyed with all the 10 plagues that happened, and the events that took place at the splitting of the Red Sea. That there was some acknowledgement eventually, and again, there could have been acknowledgement before, because, you know, Egypt, which is the name of the country, Egypt was one of the 4 sons of Ham, who was the son of Noah, and certainly Noah was a monotheist. So traditions definitely were passed down to the ancient peoples. Ron, what's your take on all this?
Like Dennis mentioned earlier, that when you try to explain or you try to show someone that their religious path has been, you know, basically detoured into just human thinking, you're taking away a very central belief system that they inherited from their parents. And it's very difficult, because we believe our parents are the ones that bear that ultimate truth to us when we were growing up. And to suddenly come to an acknowledgement that they were wrong, it's not simple. And you are basically offending their entire, you know, ancestry when you try to explain that they're basically going up the wrong path. And I mentioned before, you know, I have friends of the Hindu faith, of the Muslim faith, and we rarely, you know, speak about religion in terms of, if they're explaining something, you know, that's the only way really we get into any type of religious, you know, discussion. But it's very, very difficult, because now in America right now, where we're exposed to, you know, the information that we weren't, in, let's say, for instance, in my country back home, we can see certain inconsistencies in certain belief systems that are not accurate. For instance, today my sister was mentioning we had a superstitious belief back home that if your eye twitches, you're going to see someone you haven't seen in a long time. So her friend recently visited the doctor, and he says, whenever that happens, it means your vitamin B, your B complex is low. You need a B shot.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, I was expecting to see someone I didn't see for a long time. And this is something that people actually believe back home. But in America, in terms of enlightenment, technology, and knowledge, we as human beings, as Dennis said, like, I must, you know, go back to his words again, it's a time of enlightenment, acquisitions of knowledge is available to us now. We have to adapt, change, and understand what is right from wrong. And it's very difficult for some people.
True, true. Okay, thank you.
Don?
Dennis, yes, Dennis.
I want to quickly add something here. There is a sect within Egypt that's been around for over two millennium, and they believe in God. Their name is called Coptics. Copts is the name, C-O-P-T-S. And they've been believing in God for a long, long, long time. And they are not Muslims, but they have their own religion. And it originally started from people who are hermits that would go out in the desert and live without people for a long time in a cave or on a mountain or in the desert. And then they would come back in and say, you know, I thought about some of this stuff. And they would start discussing these. And this is how these things eventually evolved when there was oral history. But in these, I was about to say God-forsaken places, but at the time, Egypt was a very populous country or area. But the Coptics have been around for a long time. But every time there's any disagreement in Egypt, they jump on the Coptics, blame them, and use them as, or they take it out on them, let's put it that way. Just as a point of history.
Now, I know they've had some trouble in the last year with the revolution that took place in Egypt, and unfortunately, it hasn't been a very peaceful conflict. We would hope they would only have a theological conflict, but unfortunately, there has been quite a bit of violence in Egypt between the whether it be the Islamic Brotherhood or whatever branch of Islam and the Coptics, and the Coptics have cried out on an international scale. Unfortunately, they haven't been heard as much as they should have been. Dennis, with that being said, speaking of Egypt, we have a doctor, a physician, scientist, philosopher who spent the last part of his life, doctor or rabbi Moses Maimonides. And I was wondering if you have your book handy that you can read us the next section.
I do.
On the Art of Cure.
I think we're
picking up from page 61.
We're going to advance it a bit, Don, because after 61, there's very specific and technical remedies that the doctors were interested in that I don't think most of our listeners on the radio would be involved in. Things like how to stop different ways of stopping bleeding and how to care for monkeys as to what would keep them healthy. So I'd like to advance to page 67, Don.
Okay.
Which brings us to the chapter entitled Maimonides and the Making of Modern Science.
Okay. I'm there.
Good. The upsurge in Jewish learning in recent decades has brought with it an increased interest in Maimonides and his work. Acknowledged as the greatest halachic authority as well as the most profound philosopher which Judaism has produced, many generations refer to the master by the title of his great work, The Guide for the Perplexed. Although the title is still popular indeed, few take the trouble to study the work. For one thing, it seems to be truly perplexing in character. For another, many are repelled even before looking at it by its avowedly medieval form and its reputedly medieval concepts. Does Maimonides the philosopher have anything to say to us? Before that question can be asked, a prior one needs to be answered. Does not this medieval and Aristotelian background inevitably relegate Maimonides to nothing more than historical importance, making his thoughts irrelevant in the context of modern science and philosophy? Medieval Jewish philosophy has been described as the product of the attempt to reconcile religion with reason, revelation, and reflection. In general terms, this approach involved distinguishing three components of human thought, making for a kind of two-tiered intellectual structure. First, there was mapped out an area of basic truth common to both revealed religion and the philosophical speculation. For example, the principle of the existence of God was thought to be demonstrable by logical argument leading to a conclusion identical with that taught a priori by faith.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, can you, for our readers, listeners, a priori, what does that mean?
That's a Latin word for what happens prior to what we're saying or relating to. In other words, it was precluded what the subject matter is that we're talking about.
Okay, very good.
And, in the law terms, we say an a priori agreement is an agreement that was made before you came before the law.
Uh-huh.
So therefore, it has to be taken into consideration, and we don't know if we're going to continue it or change it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
On this common foundation, it was sought to erect a superstructure in which faith and reason were each assigned separate compartments in which to exercise complete and independent authority. Thus, with respect to many of the commandments, for example, tradition and revelation were the only arbiters. On the other hand, in parts of what we call today the natural sciences, philosophy alone had the final word. Although the precise boundaries between the disciplines vary from one thinker to another, the nature of the endeavor is usually the same. To delineate the shared realm, constructive efforts were required, namely to devise logical arguments to derive certain religious propositions from universally accepted premises. On the other hand, criticism was the tool to mark the boundary between the independent scopes of religion on one side and reason on the other. Invariably, as the criticism grew profounder, it tended not only to circumscribe the independent domain of each, but also to narrow their common area.
Mm-hmm.
Questioning the validity of religious teachings in any one area weakens the authority of revelation everywhere. The result was avoided by a procedure suited to a body of received document incorporated in specific texts. The method of interpretation. It was recognized that the Torah has 70 faucets. That faucets is sides or faces.
Right.
And new levels of meaning are continually to be discovered. This meant that the validity of none of the traditional material was at all in doubt. Reinterpreting its content prevented the status of Scripture being put in jeopardy. Although to some extent the technique of interpretive aegises were applied also to the corpus of Aristotelian writings and other philosophical works, the character of philosophy inquiry itself precluded such an approach. Attention to the method of scientific inquiry and general argumentation in order to define their proper limits of application led to a re-examination of fundamental issues in the theory of knowledge, the nature of laws of thought, which ultimately undermined the entire Aristotelian outlook. A major, perhaps the major concern of all Jewish thinkers is an adequate conception of the divine will. The Creator acts because he chooses to, not because he is an automaton. The principle of voluntarianism, although distinguishes the Bible, the God of the Bible, from the prime mover of Aristotle. I think we should stop here because that's a lot to digest at this time.
Okay, very good. I look forward to next week with you, Lou, you know, because I see right in front of me that it talked about what Aristotle thought. Yes, certainly this is a lot to take in. However, I do agree with you, Dennis, as well, that this is much more digestible than if we'd gone into how Maimonides had treated people with when there were tears in their blood vessels.
Well,
talked about in the previous chapter.
Yes,
at the end of the previous chapter.
This particular chapter leads into Maimonides as a scientist because in the age that he lived in and prior to that, it was only philosophers who thought about the scientific world because we didn't have any scientists roaming the earth. So here, and this is the beginning of an introduction of how Maimonides got into science. So through the philosophical doorways that were open.
True. Okay, and now we're going to, Ron, do you have any comments on this matter?
No, I don't.
Okay, so we'll go a little bit now into, as we started last week, Rambam's introduction to the Mishneh Torah, and then about 5 or 6 minutes, Ron will be signing off. We'll give Ron a chance to make any concluding statements. The mitzvah, which we talked about last week in his preface to his Mishneh Torah, means the explanation of the Torah. He did not transcribe, referring to Moses. Instead, he commanded verbally to the elders, to Joshua, and the totality of Israel. And Rambam is very careful to give a source for this, where it says in Deuteronomy chapter 13, verse 1, where it says, quote, "Be careful to observe everything I prescribe to you," unquote. "For this reason it is called the oral law." Now, even though the oral law was not transcribed, Moses, our teacher, taught it in its entirety in his court to the 70 elders. Eleazar was one of the sons of Aaron the high priest, the older brother of Moses, Pinchas, who was a grandson of Aaron, and Joshua, who eventually led the 12 tribes in the land of Israel, received the tradition from Moses. In particular, Moses transmitted the oral law to Joshua, who was his primary disciple, and instructed him regarding it. Similarly, throughout the life of Joshua, Yeshua, he taught the oral law. Now, Joshua was the leader of Israel for 30 years after the 40 years of leadership of Moses. Many elders received the tradition from him, and Eli received the tradition from the elders and from Pinchas. And then Samuel the prophet, who we learn about, who anointed the eventual King David, received the tradition from Eli. In fact, we see Samuel the prophet as a young boy being taken by his mother Hannah to Eli at the time of the tabernacle that stood in the land of Israel at that time. So Samuel received the oral Torah tradition from Eli in the court, and then David received the tradition from Samuel in his court. And next week, hopefully, we'll continue who is receiving these oral Torah traditions aside from the written traditions. Ron, any comments and any concluding points before you sign off for tonight?
Not really. Just listening.
Okay. Well, I mean, this is just to show that, we could reach further, but I just want to stop here. And I want to thank you, Ron, for coming on the show and giving us that insight into the Hindu faith. And again, I want to be very careful here that we are not advocating anyone going out to breaking any Hindu idols. Really, it's upon those who call themselves Hindus to decide what shall be their destiny. You know, contrary to belief, the spirit of the Seven High Commandments does not have a mandate that, say, you have a country of one faith being sanctioned by the Torah of invading another country of another faith because of theological differences. Actually, the whole idea of the spirit, maybe Ron will want to talk about this before he leaves the show tonight, that the whole spirit of the Seven High Commandments is a form of self-empowerment for the individual, for the community, and for, as the self-empowerment grows and spreads out, for that the governing body of that person and the community, and if that community actually branches out into a nation state or series of countries, therefore these laws should be enacted. But before that time comes, it's really we're advocating people engage in these personal acts of consciousness ascension, just as I would encourage any Jew to ascend in his or her consciousness to become more aware of, educated of what their obligations are as human beings. So, Ron, your take on that matter and why we, although we do not agree with the faith of Hinduism by worshiping of idols, whatever their source came from, we are not advocating as people who are non-Hindus to break their idols. So your take on that?
No, you're 100% correct. This is, basically we are in the process of, besides educating ourselves, hoping to educate others in the way of coming to a self-awareness of self and our connection to the Creator and understanding the commandments in which he gave to us to uphold, which is basically for our benefit in terms of our relationship to each other in this world and our relationship ultimately to him. So, I mean, the whole idea of this program and myself and you, Dan, we share this, you know, constantly in our conversations besides this, the show, that we're hoping that we awaken that search, that spark in everyone to come in, to acquire that knowledge in which the Torah is offering to each and every one of us, to have a sincere, realistic, and a when I say realistic, I mean in the sense of we're not coming from a perspective of our own ideas, but that which the Torah has mandated from the day Noah left the ark until today. Mm-hmm. And we're appealing to everyone, and we're not looking from the perspective of what race or religion you're from, because these are universal laws, and mm-hmm. It's our responsibility as human beings. As Dennis always mentioned, you know, it's a human thing. It's not about a race or religion. So we have nothing. We're not advocating any kind of harm or injury in any possible way to any one of a specific religion. We're just asking that you try to open yourself up to the knowledge that we share with you. So that's what I have to say. Yeah.
Thank you, Ron. That was beautiful. And I want to wish you a pleasant evening. And hopefully you'll be able to join us next week. And, we're going to take a musical break now. Dennis, would you like to chime in on anything that Ron said before we take our musical break?
Yes, I would. There are people who have lived a lifetime on the planet and never heard of the Bible, never heard of the Ten Commandments. We cannot hold that against them. God will accept anybody in heaven who he thinks qualifies. Mm-hmm. But we don't make that judgment. That is God.
Right.
If you lived your life the best way you could under the circumstances, and if God can accept that, then we believe you have a chance of getting into heaven. However, if you do have a chance, you should be able to learn or inquire about other things, other holy directives, commandments, the Bible. There are better ways. And if you give me 10 or 15 minutes, I'll convince you. However, however, God loves you. And if you love God in return, you found a friend, and maybe he'll open up the doors to heaven for you.
Amen. Amen. Thank you, Dennis. Now, gentlemen, and any of you blessed are listening out there, we're gonna turn to some nice music. This is by Joshua Sirk. Now, Joshua Sirk is a practicing son of Noah, and he wrote a song a couple years ago. Actually, it was put on YouTube on September 18, 2011, and this song is called E7/5 Blues Off the Cuff. It's about 3 minutes, so we'll listen to some nice blues from Joshua Sirk. If you want to connect more to his music on YouTube, you would have to type in Y and then K-E-R-O-U-A-C. That's Y-K-E-R-O-U-A-C. And then you can subscribe and you can get some of his fresher music. So this is E7/5 Blues Off the Cuff. Enjoy it, everyone, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes and 12 seconds. Okay, Blessed Souls, that was from the YouTube website, Y Kerouac, Y-K-E-R-O-U-A-C. That was known as Joshua Sirk, who lives out in the fields, the beautiful land of Pennsylvania here in the United States of America. We've got about 37 minutes to go. I'm here with Dennis Ryan, our co-host. Ron Williams, our other co-host, just left as he makes his preparation to get up way too early in the morning, but that's what he has to do to try to survive. And now we're going to go on to the next segment of our show. And this is concerning the teachings of the sages of Israel called Pirkei Avot, literally the ethics of the fathers, one of the 48 methods by which one can internalize the Torah. And we're going to embellish it with the wisdoms, the Chachma of Rabbi Nachman, who lived from 1772 to went to the next level of life in 1810. So he says the following: that one should know, my beloved ones and my son, that it is an essential aspect of acquiring the Torah for someone who can give instruction. And we're not just talking about someone who teaches it, but actually can give Jewish law decisions, that they should not be rejoicing in the fact that they were given such a blessing. That for the sake of this, in fact, we did receive the Torah on Mount Sinai, in order that we should toil and to try to understand the depths of the Torah, until that certain people are actually meritorious to be instructors in specific legal matters among the Jewish people, among ourselves. And this is the idea that one of the names for Mount Zion, it is called Har HaMoriah, meaning it's the mountain of instruction. That from there, in fact, in prophetical teachings from the book of Isaiah, for Zion shall go out the Torah, meaning that, that there will come a time, as there was in ancient days, before the Common Era, that people would go up to Jerusalem to ask of the sages of Israel. And in those ancient days, before the destruction of the first temple, you not had just wise people, you had people with prophetic insight as well. However, someone, and he was talking about now, of course, someone from our days and from his days until now, until the blessed days of the coming of the Messiah may become speedily in our days in a peaceful and pleasant manner, that someone who does become that level of instructor, of teacher, that the only reason why he has been put in that position to do so is that he's been blessed to do the will of the Most High, to elucidate in these matters, to bring out what is known as law, just as Rambam Maimonides did, for the sake of heaven, for the sake of the creator of the world, and not to rejoice with an arrogance and self-aggrandizement because he is now officially entitled an instructor of instruction among the Jewish people. And of course, this also is applicable to the Noahide, the blessed nations of the world, because we should not be surprised to see, and it should be speaking of days, with the coming of the Messiah, that judges will rise up among the nations to judge over the cases in their individual nation states, their provinces, their cities, the municipalities. And they also should not think that just because they've been given this elated position to be instructors of Torah, that this should give them an entitlement to self-aggrandizement over another person. Because we do see that when people have come, and I'm not bringing this now from Rabbi Nachman, but I was from the Talmudic tractate Passover or Pesachim, which is the oral Torah tradition, how we Jewish people keep Pesach. That if a person becomes haughty over his wisdom, he shall lose his wisdom. And it's also brought down in the Talmudic tractate there that a prophet who becomes haughty because of his ability to prophesy will lose his powers of prophecy. And one of the great instructors of the nation of Israel, Hillel the Elder, Hillel the Zaken, was actually cited in the Talmudic tractate. I think it's on the 66th page, on the second half of the page. That one time he became a little haughty, too haughty for his level, in giving instruction, and he actually forgot some of the laws that he was teaching. So this is a humbling experience for someone who is actually raised up to be an instructor of Torah, not just in the simple, again, like what we're doing here on the show. We're not really giving instruction on a law basis, but rather trying to encourage people to be aware of such information is available, or information like this is available for you, blessed souls, to feast upon with your human consciousness and see what you want to digest, and what you don't want to digest, that's fine too. But we are not in that category. But we are rejoicing the fact that we get to share Torah, but we are not rejoicing the fact that we have been picked as some sort of high and haughty type of teachers, instructors, or Judaical law deciders. That's not my role here as a member of the Jewish people, but more as a Torah activist. But that's the main point, blessed souls, is that when a person, for those people who are elevated to the point of becoming judges, not to be rejoicing in the fact they've been chosen to be judges, but rather they should continually have a fear of the Most High, and when they give instruction, they should do for the sake of heaven. Dennis, any comments, questions, concerns about this one of these attributes, how a person can internalize the Torah by not rejoicing over the fact he's been elevated over other people with his understanding of biblical scripture?
Well, I look at this by taking a step back, Don. And we have the Ten Commandments, and we have 613 laws. The more laws there are, the more complexities will arise from a human sense. And we do need those people who need the law to be understood and decided so that people who are of the same faith, or maybe not the same faith, need some type of a decision so that they can go about their lives and not get hung up on these little things of different interpretations or misunderstandings. So for the goodness of humanity, we always need some people who can arbitrate as judges. However, this is indeed an extraordinary human power, because now you have a responsibility over other humans. You must be very, very humble to be able to do this, because you must remember it has a great impact. But we have to be careful that the same person is not arbitrating between humanity and God, but certainly humans to humans. So therefore, we do need people of this caliber, and we expect them to be of the highest quality that we can admire, because it's not an easy job to do.
No. And I think, Dennis, you know, among the Jewish people, our living example, although he's passed on for many years, was the mighty Moses from the oral Torah tradition. That, you know, going back to this concept of idolatry, that we have an oral Torah tradition that Moses looked upon even any idolater, and he said in his utmost humility, and he, it's testified about him, he was actually instructed by the Most High to write down that he was the most humble man upon the face of the earth, that the mighty Moses, the Levite prophet, the one who received those Ten Commandments in Mount Sinai, appraised himself in the following manner, that if that idolater was Moses, and he was the idolater, that idolater, given his talents and abilities and intellectual faculties, would actually be a better Moses than the original Moses himself. We see that Moses, this type of instruction was certainly fulfilled by the original Moses, and I'm sure to a very great extent, as much as possible, it was exemplified by the one who was called from Moses to Moses, there never rose another like Moses, Moses Maimonides. And you know, again, those of us who are not these type of judges, at least we can rejoice in the fact that we're trying to foster a conversation within human consciousness. Not that we're better than anyone. I know you don't feel that way, Ron. I mean, Dennis, excuse me. And I try to avoid those type of feelings, that people really should see that, you know, again, as we mentioned in previous shows, we were taken out of the dust and given something so precious that there's no precious metal that's more precious than the human soul. And yet we, dwellers of dust, starting from the dust, we were given something so precious. So we were given something for nothing was, we were not charged. We were basically then given a responsibility to look over this earth. But we have a responsibility to remind ourselves that we have to be honest with ourselves and hopefully ask of others, not necessarily by asking them directly, but by trying to exemplify this type of human honesty, that we are happy with our portions, but we are not happy with our knowledge. Because I think the type of knowledge I would be happy with, Dennis, is that if I could implement the solutions that I think that need to be implemented to stop war and disease and pestilence and famine and child abuse and drug abuse and spouse abuse, but I haven't come up with those solutions. So I have, in my personal consciousness, I have nothing to be proud about because I haven't come up with the solutions. And I would think, too, that even a judge, even a great disperser, a great promoter of Torah teachings, whether it be oral or written traditions, has no right to be proud because they're only able to, as you mentioned before, arbitrate in specific instances where people need help, but that doesn't mean they're going to serve or solve all the world's problems. We're hoping that one shall come eventually on a very human level, will educate the rest of us on a very human, naturalized level, not supernatural level, on a very natural level, to help us work out our human problems in a humble and, yes, in a joyful fashion. Any feedback on what I just said?
Yes. The Maimonides was a famous judge, but the one thing he did was he explained to both sides what his decision was so that they could understand it and go forth and feel like they gained something out of it. To me, he was an extraordinary type of person when he did this because it puts a lot of pressure on him. However, we do have a couple of points that he was asked to comment on that are in the Bible. One of them was the theory of the bird in the nest. I don't know if you're familiar or not with it, but it is a very tough judging situation. It's a corundum of the judging world. And what he did was he rendered two judgments on the same idea. Mm-hmm. And today, scholars still look at it and they say, which one is the real one? Or are they both going to run in parallel? So even Maimonides, it was so humble that there's some things he could not split in half. Just like Solomon did not split the baby in half.
Right, right. There's actually in certain places in the Talmudic literature, Dennis, and for anyone who was not aware of this, that the Talmudic commentators or the rabbis who engage in the actual discussion of some matter in Jewish law could not come up to with a final conclusive reasoning, which would eventually congeal into what we would call Jewish law. So what their conclusive statement was, we'll have to wait until Elijah the prophet comes in the days of the Messiah to clarify this point, because it's just not clear to us yet. So, you know, we do see that these were great. Anyone who was quoted in the Talmud was considered to be a great scholar of written and oral Torah, but yet these people were humble enough to be recorded for basically eternity until the coming of the Messiah and the reemergence of Elijah the prophet with the resurrection of those who lie in the dust, that they don't know, they didn't know the true answer. And this is also a sign of humility of a true judge, when some of them say, hey, I don't know. And I do know that the Lubavitch Rebbe, may his merits protect us, he at times, I can't say how many times, but he said, I don't know. I don't have the answer for this, or we'll have to wait and see. And that's why I follow his teachings today as an inspiration. And I have not, if it's in the Mishnah Torah, I'm not sure what that section you were talking about, that discussion, Dennis, but I'll try to keep my eye on the lookout to try to learn more about it. But it doesn't surprise me that the Rambam could come up with dual reasonings, and which is not just because he felt that's what should be done, but as an expression of his own humility.
But if anybody has that, humility, you know you have limitations.
Yeah, true. We're going to move on, Dennis, and bless his soul, to our next section for Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition, by David Sears, plucking out from a prophetic teaching from Isaiah, chapter 38, verse 17. Quote, behold, for peace I had great bitterness, end of quote. Just as all cures require bitter remedies, so does peace, which is a cure for everything. As the prophet Isaiah also states, quote, peace, peace to the far and near, says God, and I will heal him, end of quote. And that's in Isaiah chapter 57, verse 19. And this is something that Rabbi Nachman, who we just talked about, plucked out of from the prophetic teachings of Isaiah the prophet. And another two teachings I'd like to bring out, and then we'll ask Dennis to comment. On the subject of wars between nations and Nina's bloodshed, and of course, unfortunately, we still hear too much about wars between nations and needless bloodshed, Rabbi Nachman said, quote, many foolish beliefs that people once held, such as forms of idolatry that demanded child sacrifice, etc., have disappeared. But as of yet, the foolish belief in the pursuit of war has not disappeared, end of quote. And Rabbi Nachman actually used to ridicule certain scientists, saying, quote, what great thinkers they must be. What ingenuity they must possess to invent amazing weapons that can kill thousands of people at once. Is there any greater foolishness than this, to murder so many people for nothing? End of quote. And that's, again, a teaching from Rabbi Nachman. And one more teaching before we turn to Dennis for some feedback. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov predicted, quote, the Messiah will conquer the world without a shot being fired. Dennis, we bit off a lot. And I'll ask you to give some feedback on it, if you wish.
Well, the first one that you mentioned falls into the category that two wrongs don't make a right. If there's two warring factions, there is no winner, because they started off on the wrong foot. And that just means they have to do away with their opponent, which is not a positive idea. So we were taught what is right and wrong, but somehow some people think that if they're wrong enough, they're going to be right. What crazy mixed up thinking got into their mind? We must always be aware of what is right and what is wrong. The second part, peace. Humans have a real hard time with peace. Peace exists in the minds of people as long as they don't have to worry about anything when they wake up in the morning. But there's always something you're going to worry about. But peace says you must overlook these things because you have a greater purpose. You have a greater objective. God is greater than every human. Peace is a good thing. And yet, we've had people who have been on the earth here who said peace should be practiced. And some of them ended up in the wrong place. Some of them won out. You take Mahatma Gandhi of India. He practiced peace no matter how much he was beaten or his followers were beaten or anything. They said their idea of peace is going to exist no matter what. Jesus of Nazareth said, I come in peace. And right away, people became very suspicious of him. What is his motive? What is he pushing peace for? Well, peace doesn't need a motive. It's a good thing. If you can't accept it, then you're going to reject it. Or you're going to use human thinking to bypass it.
True. Dennis, can I interrupt? I think also Dr. Martin Luther King promoted peace, from what I understand, although I was only 6 years old when he was murdered. But he mentioned that he has been to the top of the mountain and seen the promised land. You know, I'm understanding that, and maybe, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that he reached a certain level of peacefulness within his consciousness to realize that he had nothing to fear. And unfortunately, he was cut down by that in that cruel day in Memphis. He was cut down in 1968. But there's another man that practiced peace. His demonstrations were of peace.
That's correct, Don. And I just didn't hit me as I was speaking at the time. But he had nothing to fear. But that's what makes him fearful. That's what the fear is evoked in other people. What do you mean he's not fearful? Well, I'll make him fearful. He better be fearful. They don't understand this, that you have peace of the mind and you have peace in your life. You must emphasize the good things. But there are some people that say, wait a minute, there must be something wrong with this guy if he's just pushing peace. And that's what a lot of it bothers, irritates humans. What do you mean, peace? They can't visualize it sometimes. They just don't have enough faith or belief in God.
True. Dennis, do you remember, I mean, you know, when I was a young boy, I saw an episode of Star Trek, and I remember there was like two arch enemies. There was the Federation and the Klingons. And they were once on the same ship, and there was some sort of spiritual force on the ship that was causing them to have baseless hatred of each other. And when they would have these little clashes on board the Enterprise, the force would get stronger. And then somehow, I don't know if it was just on the side of the Enterprise, the Federation characters, or the Klingon characters in collaboration, they realized that if they were at peace, that this spiritual force would dissipate and eventually leave the Enterprise, and there would be a temporary peace agreement. And of course, this was just Hollywood entertainment, but it was making a very strong point how hatred fuels more hatred.
I watched all the Star Treks when they first began. I think I've seen them 5 or 6 times over and over. And I've always been amazed at the creative thought that was there, because they brought out our human differences. There was one episode, real quick, like, where these people were killing each other on the planet. And the reason was that some people were black on the left and white on the right, while the other was just the opposite. So what happens is they kept fighting. Finally, the Enterprise came along and said, hey, what are you fighting about? And they really couldn't explain it, except they said the other person was black on the left. That was their sole basis of having a war and killing people.
Right.
I mean, we humans will pick out little things, magnify them, and think they're justified, and we push ahead. We're deceiving ourselves. There's something more important than us.
True. Okay, let's move on. We have 2 more segments, and then we'll play some music by our good friend David Dome from England. From the Path of the Righteous Gentile, again, from the chapter on tshuva, repentance, on page 32, teaching 15, that every person should consider himself or herself perfectly balanced between war, reward, and punishment. Similarly, he should see the entire world as similarly balanced because of his deeds or her deeds. If he or she commits one sin, he or she tilts the scales of judgment for himself or herself and for the entire world towards guilt and condemnation. And consequently, he can be in the cause of the whole world's destruction. But if he or she does one good deed, he or she can tilt the scales of judgment for himself or herself and the whole world towards merit and can bring salvation and deliverance for himself and the whole world. Now again, in the negative, first a person is causing judgment for himself, and then is going to influence the world towards, unfortunately, guilt and condemnation, like, say, in Sodom and Gomorrah. But when the person is doing what is right here, that the person is causing merit for himself and for the entire world. So it really behooves us to try to do good for ourselves and good for the world. Any take on this teaching, Dennis?
Yes, this goes back to right and wrong. You're going to do some wrong and you're going to do some good. It balances out. And that balancing is in your mind, and it's called your conscience, because your conscience will remind you if you did something that was harmful, hurtful, or maybe you didn't mean to do. So we always have the hope that we can always adjust this. And as long as we can adjust it, we can feel like we're balanced between bad and good. We can do it on the human scale, and we can do it on a scale that God can find acceptable too. We hope and pray that we do the right thing to offset the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Going back in a similar vein to part 3 of this chapter on returning to God, the power of self-determination is given to every person. If a person wants to direct himself or herself towards good and righteousness, The power is in his or her hand. If he or she wants to direct himself or herself to the way of evil, the power is similarly his or hers. And by the way, this is the teaching of Rambam Maimonides, Laws of Repentance, in Chapter 5, Law 2. And I just want to mention here one more thing. This is coming from a teaching from Purim from 26 years ago by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that one should banish the idea that fools speak about, that God has decreed man's destiny from birth, whether he will be righteous or wicked. There is no such thing. Every person has the ability to become righteous or wicked, compassionate or cruel, generous or selfish. And so it is with all other character traits and abilities to live within the normative conduct set for man by the commandments of God. Now, it is true, however, that a person can be born with tendencies towards specific problematic behavior or behaviors, but at all times it is within his or her power to overcome these natural tendencies. No one is born a thief or a sexual deviant. And again, that last point here, where no one is born a thief or a sexual deviant, is based on the teaching of Rambam's Laws of Repentance, Chapter 5, Law 4. There's any comments, insights you'd like to share with us on these two teachings?
We were all born with free will. That means you decide. But you must be responsible for what you decide. You can pick a good thing. You can pick a bad thing. That's your choice. But you're responsible for it. And somebody, you, has to make payment for it. And I'm sorry, but that's just the way it works out. Nobody's given free check to go do good things and do bad things. We're all beholden to rules and regulations of what humanity has created. But on the same level, or a higher level, we're committed to what God has in store for us. But our free will is our choice to make that decision. You can always change your mind, because free will works both ways, and multiple times. We have many people who have done many bad things for many years, and all of a sudden they have an epiphany of some type, and they start doing good things. They weren't born that way. They were born with a free will. You have the choice. Use it well.
Thank you, Dennis. Now we're going to move on to the last section, and, excuse me, going to Genesis chapter 2, verse 10, and really we have to also feed off something we reflected on last week, and that is that the concept of the tree of life. Now, we assert as students of Torah, at least I do, that according to the oral Torah traditions, that the Most High has embedded in every molecule, fiber of creation, life. And so therefore, it does not trouble us the fact that there was something called the tree of life, because it happened to be a tree that was connected to true consciousness of the Creator, higher than what is right or wrong, just acknowledging that everything is from God. And therefore, when we read from this verse in chapter 2, verse 10, a river went out of Eden to water the garden, which was the Garden of Eden, and from there it divided and became four headwaters. So from the oral Torah tradition, that this stream of water that went out and is described as a river going out of Eden emerged from under the tree of life. So allegorically speaking, we want to get allegorical, that, you know, this oral Torah tradition is also talking about a literal going out of this spring from underneath the physical tree of life, that this water had a great advantage to it because it was coming out of the tree of life from what was, again, it was a physical tree of life, but it was also symbolically the fact that anything which is representative of life or an example of life is something which is exemplifying the fact that the Most High is giving it life. So therefore, this water, these waters, were considered to be, just as you have a tree of life, waters of life. And wisdom is likened to water. And a tree is something which is implanted in the ground, and its roots are hidden, well hidden, the essential roots, which are connected to the essential group of the tree. I mean, eventually you see some roots pop up through the ground, some sort of tree formations, that the roots of this tree develop unseen by the eye, yet we see the trunk, we see the body of the tree, we see the branches, we see the luscious fruit that come from a tree. So on the most simple level, say like an apple tree or an orange tree, these are trees of life because they are testifying to it. The fact that the Most High implanted within life, and yet here too, the embellishment here is that water, which is likened to wisdom, now is being described as a river. And river is allegorically discussed in the teaching of the inner dimensions of Torah, in the Chassidus and in the Kabbalah, as referring to understanding. And again, this Garden of Eden, a garden of delight, was the source of all wisdom, the source of all understanding. And then it divided and became four headwaters. Now, it looks like with the time that we have, we're not going to be able to go into which four headwaters they were, and hopefully next week we'll start to cover that. But Dennis, any comments, concerns, questions, anything you want to add to this discussion here about this idea that if something's coming out of the Garden of Eden and it's connected to the Tree of Life, in itself is an emissary of life.
Create a parallelism in people's heads. A human is like a tree. We're given so much energy to live our life, and then we die. Trees do the same thing that humans do. Yet, we're told that it was a garden, and in there, they started planting stuff, and it had sustenance called water. Fine. Nothing wrong with that. Humans don't have leaves, but the concept is a parallelism that it cannot be denied, that we are replications or phantom beings of a tree, because they work in parallel. God created all of nature. God created all humans. There is no difference. He just gave us a soul and an intellect and a different form, his form. Now, regarding trees, most people understand trees. You don't have to explain a tree. But a lot of people believe there's a family tree, and they put names of the people on the branches who belong in their family. But that tree really doesn't exist, but the family does. And the family had to come from somewhere, and the family is going somewhere, because the family tree is going to go on and on. So we have different representations that humans use for trees, and we do it quite willingly because we have no compunction about that. You don't say, oh, I hate that tree, or, oh, that tree is bad, evil. No such thing. It's nature.
Right.
So therefore, we accept it. So use the tree as an image. And remember, it's only there for a short period of time. And it lives longer than humans in most cases.
Sure.
Oh,
sure.
And those rivers? Yes, I'm dying to talk about those rivers, Don.
Okay. So we'll, hopefully next week, Dennis, on our next show, we'll meet down by the river and we'll immerse ourselves in those four rivers with the rest of our blessed audience. I want to thank you, Dennis, for coming on the show tonight. And we're going to end the show, Blessed Souls, with our friend and brother David Dome, who will help us get back home, to get off scrimmage with our divine image, or Tzelem Elohim, which is no dream, because we have to understand, where are we now? Where are you now? We're holding right now in this moment with the great opportunity to be thankful that we're alive, and hopefully we can share those blessings with others in a peaceful and pleasant manner. Take care, everyone. Where Are You Now by David Dome. Help us get back home. Take care, everyone.
Thank you.